Hello, you're very welcome to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM, the programme and podcast for teachers, policymakers and anyone with an interest in teaching and learning. I'm Sean Delaney and you can download podcasts of previous programmes by going to seandelaney.com and clicking on the podcasts tab. Later on this week's programme, I hear from a teacher who was a guest on some previous programmes about the teaching of science and other subjects, and about how she is planning the build-up to Christmas with her children in second class. But first, I'm bringing you the final part of my conversation with David Dido, the teacher, writer, blogger and trainer who wants you to constantly question everything you know about education. One of his books is titled, What If Everything You Knew About Education Was Wrong? In this part of the interview, I noted to David that I really liked his conversational, flowing writing style, and I asked him how hard he works at that.
Well, I do work at it. It's like most things, that the more you practice it, the easier it becomes. So I used to read, I don't know if you've come across Phil Beadle. So he's an English educator, teacher, and he was on a lot of teacher TV in the 90s, and he was like my educational hero. And he wrote a book called How to Teach, which was very funny. You're very, very witty. There were some sort of dirty jokes in there. And for me, sort of having read or been exposed to really dry, boring teacher education books on my university course, you know, this was a breath of, I wouldn't perhaps say fresh, but you know, slightly fetid air. But it was wonderful and it liberating, and it communicated with me in a way which the drier academic tones didn't. And so when I started writing, I almost self-consciously was seeking to sort of imitate Phil Beadle's style. And obviously, you know, you can only go so far with that sort of thing. I'm not the same. I've become friends with him, actually. He's a really great chap. But we disagree about quite a few things. And I found my own voice over the years. And so, you know, I don't think I'm anywhere near as irreverent as he is. But, you know, I do like to sort of be conversational. So things like, one of the things that I was very deliberate at is that I would use contractions. So if rather than will not, I'd always make it won't, because it's a little bit more informal. It's a little bit easier to read. So, I mean, it's not hard for anybody to
do. But do you do lots of drafting?
Yeah, I do lots. I mean, I write very, very quickly, and I'm a shockingly poor writer in terms of technical accuracy. I was diagnosed at school with dyslexia, which is ironic as I sort of write about dyslexia not really being a thing. But I'm not very good at spelling and these sorts of things. And so I write and then I read it back and it's utter gobbledygook. And so I have to do quite a bit of sort of, what did I mean? What was I trying to get across? So things like, I always mix up D's and G's. Always. But also, you know, I've learned a lot about my weaknesses. Like, I know I can't spell believe. So I know that believe is meant to have a lie in it, L-I-E. And I always automatically get the E and the I the wrong way around. And so I know that if I've used the word believe, it will be spelt wrong. I just need to check and see if there's a lie in it. You know, so I have sort of workarounds to compensate for my weaknesses. But I, you know, writing is something that I, you know, it's a joy for me. You can't stop me doing it. So I go on holiday and I write, you know, because it's fun. And I've always written, but in the past nobody was interested. I started writing about education and found an audience, and that's been a real joy. You know, every writer wants a reader.
One of the things that attracted my attention to the book was the title, What If Everything You Knew About Education Was Wrong? But what other titles did you consider before you settled on that one?
I came to that idea quite quickly. I mean, how to phrase that was important, because I started off with the idea of the title being Everything You Know About Education Is Wrong. And the feedback I got from people was like, oh, that's quite aggressive. And phrasing it as a question is much more an invitation then to think, what if it was? You know, using the subjunctive. What would you do if you found out if it was wrong? And so there's more scope for challenging the kind of certainty that I wanted the book to do with it being a question. And I read an article by Laura McInerney, who's now the editor of Schools Week, a teaching magazine in the UK. And she'd written an article called What If Everything You Knew About Education Was Wrong? And I shamelessly stole it as the title of my book. So I thought that actually captures the not just the kind of the idea of the content, but the kind of questioning nature of what I'd like it to do.
A more recent book is What Every Teacher Needs to Know About Psychology. What's that about?
Ha! Well, psychology. That's an interesting one, actually. I wrote it with a psychologist, a guy called Nick Rose, who's got a brain the size of a planet. He's one of the most knowledgeable, intelligent, and passionate people I know in education. And so writing with him was an absolute, not just a treat, but I learned so much from that process. And when we sort of started talking about writing the book, it was really interesting, the responses that we'd get. So I mentioned it to a few people. I'm writing this book about psychology for teachers, and they'd say things like, oh, great, it's about time we had more of that sort of, you know, therapy type stuff. And I was like, no, that's not what we want. And other people saying, oh, I hate all that touchy-feely nonsense. I can't be bothered with any of that psychology. And so the type of psychology that we're writing is not touchy-feely, therapy-type psychology, you know, therapeutic, clinical psychology. It's cognitive psychology, and it's looking at how children learn, how children think, and we also look at sort of behaviour and motivation and that those areas. We, in a completely arbitrary sense, decided were the most important areas for teachers to know about. And so the book begins by looking at memory, and there's a few chapters on working memory, long-term memory, cognitive load theory, and then it looks at things like practice and feedback and assessment. There's a chapter on the psychology of assessment, and then we move into part two of the book's all about behaviour and motivation. So we look at things like children's beliefs, their ideas about mindset. We look at behaviourism, rewards and punishment. We look at in-group, out-group psychology and how that can be harnessed in ways that make classroom environments more favourable for children's learning. And then the last part of the book deals with areas of debate, contentious areas that are being talked about, and we wanted to sort of air the research behind them, but in a kind of cautious way to say, you really do need to know about this stuff, but you also need to be cautious about it. So, but it's trying to be as unpolemic as we could make it. Obviously, you know, our biases are revealed throughout, but we really try not to say this is right, that's wrong, but here's the research and here's what's useful from it. So each chapter ends with a bullet pointed summary of what might be most useful for teachers to sort of go away and do as a result of.
David, you're active as a writer, a blogger, and a publisher on social media. How do you go about doing your work day to day?
I mean, I've read a lot of stuff from writers who say, you talk about sort of discipline of writing. I don't have any discipline at all. I write because I want to write. If I don't fancy it, I don't do it. You know, if the spirit moves me, then it's effortless. And I write, you know, sometimes I can be writing for hours and hours, you know, really without, and I miss skipping meals. And then sometimes I'll go weeks writing without writing anything. What I find is that I do a lot of reading. I think a lot, so all my writing tends to be informed by the reading that I'm doing, and I'll read things, and sometimes it will seem completely unconnected to education, but it's like putting a casserole on a back burner. It's sort of stewing away, and every now and again, you know, I'll sort of look in and go, ah, and something will crystallise, gel, and suddenly I'll have an idea for something I want to communicate. But it's there's no planning. There's no, you know, I'm the least organised person.
And when you say you read a lot, do you ration your use of social media, or is that fairly?
Do you know, I struggle with that.
Okay.
I do struggle with that. I try and be disciplined. I do a lot of driving, travelling in my day to day, and so I found that audiobooks and podcasts are a really useful way to use my time when I couldn't actually physically be reading to absorb ideas as well. One of the consequences of I read less fiction than I used to, because if I feel that if I've got the time to sort of sit down with something, then I really ought to be reading a journal or a paper or some non-fiction tome. So at the moment I'm reading a really fascinating book called The Neuroscience of Intelligence by Richard Hayer, and I'm learning loads from it, but it's not, none of it's directly applicable to what as yet right. to what teachers do in classrooms, but the connection comes.
We're coming near the end. Just a few general questions. First of all, who or what inspires you?
There's the, you know, the sort of the slightly shameful idea of I am sort of motivated by readers. I want people to like what I write. I'm always pleased when people comment on the style of the writing and sort of say that they like that as much as I am by the content of it. Obviously the content's more important. So I'm really inspired by that idea of wanting to write for an audience and to try and persuade people and make a difference. Are you asking, are there any individuals or heroes that have inspired
you? Yeah, and particularly any educators that that you would look up to?
Yeah, well, one of the, I mean, big influence on me is Dylan William, who, you know, is like the rock star of education research and education writing in the UK. And if people have heard of a researcher or an educator, they've heard of Dylan William. And he's been remarkably generous with his time and given me a lot of feedback on my ideas in writing and also asked me to comment on stuff that he's written himself. And so I found him a huge inspiration. I already mentioned earlier Dan Willingham over in the States. When he sort of got back and said, that's a good idea, or recommend. I listened to a podcast that he did in the States, where at the end of it he recommended my book to teachers, and that was a big moment. Yeah, I mean, yeah. A huge amount.
Yeah.
I've been inspired by Doug Lamov, of the Teach Like a Champion guy, and Rob Coe, who's professor of education up at Durham University. I find him, you know, quite inspiring. I find him very inspiring. Rob, I find you very inspiring. You know, there's the community of teachers and educators on Twitter have been a huge source of inspiration. So me, I am completely a product of social media. If I hadn't have dipped my toe into that particular sort of pool of water, I wouldn't be having this conversation with you today.
And finally, David, what from your own primary or post-primary education informs your work in education today, if anything?
Do you mean my primary school that I went to?
Yeah. Did that shape how you ultimately relate to education and think about it?
I don't know, really. I mean, primary school seems like a long time ago. But, you know, and some of the memories I have of it are negative. So, you know, I remember sort of, you know, developing a strong sense of injustice as a result of my primary education. And, you know, so when I was, I must have been 7, 8 years old, something like that, I was really struggling to read. I think I mentioned, you know, I was diagnosed with dyslexia. And my teacher said to my mum, we just don't think David's going to learn to read. We just think he's, you know, bless him. And she said, well, we'll see about that. She took me out of school for I don't know how long. Couple of weeks, and sent me back in and said he can read now. She taught me to read. You know, I don't really have a clear memory of that process beyond reading Janet and John books and hating them with an absolute vengeance. But I learned to read. So I had some quite negative experiences of my teachers. But those negative experiences, I think, then go on to be positive in that you think, well, I really need to combat that kind of low expectations and sort of beliefs about what children can and can't do. And I'm not accusing or pointing the finger at primary teachers at all. That was just my experience. I mean, I didn't do well at school. I was not a successful student. I left school with, a very modest set of qualifications. And I've become over the years, I see myself as a bit of a sort of an autodidact. You know, I've taught myself a lot. And so the decision, relatively late in life, I was 29 when I trained to be a teacher, and part of the motivation there was to make it different to everything I'd experienced. I think, and the more I speak about that idea, it seems that that's not uncommon, that quite a few teachers come from that kind of background.
I think David Dido is correct about that. The desire to provide a better experience for other students motivates many prospective teachers to enter the teaching profession. Well, Jane Shimizu is a teacher who has appeared on the programme before. She and I were in the same year in college, and her enthusiasm and passion for teaching are as fresh and vigorous today as they were when we were student teachers in the 1980s. Jane has a particular interest in the teaching of science, but first I asked her to describe for me what the atmosphere in her classroom is like a couple of weeks before Christmas.
First of all, I'm in a junior school, and I'm in the senior class of the junior school, in other words, second class, and just the atmosphere is incredible. It's all talk about Christmas, and of course, since the Christmas toy show, it's all talk about Christmas, but, you know, in a junior school, it takes us a while to do the art. So there's a huge blitz of really nice art. And as it's done, it goes up on all the notice boards outside the classrooms, which, of course, encourages everybody to do their own bit. And we have a big carol service that we do in the church. We're having that on the night of the 21st. So all the junior infants dress as characters from the story. We tell them they can dress up. Mind you, we do get a few Darth Vaders and things like that as well, Supermen. But most of them do dress up from the Christmas story, and they sit around the altar, and then all the other classes will sing songs. Each class takes three or four songs that they sing, and then the story runs through it. It's absolutely gorgeous. So we're getting ready for that. We're practicing for that too. And then, of course, you know, with the literacy, there's all about lists and letter writing and cards and Christmas cards and one for everybody in the class. And really, it's lovely.
So Christmas really takes over in all subjects.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it becomes the main thing. Now, in a junior school, we start on the 1st of December. We couldn't start any earlier because we'd been doing it for such a long time. Well, we do actually make Advent wreaths and things before that so that we're actually ready for Advent. And since we are practicing in the church, we get to see the Advent wreath that's in there. We're right next door to a church, so we walk over and back. The Advent wreath is a wreath of green leaves, and it's got five candles then, four purple candles, a pink candle and a white candle. And a candle is lit each week of Advent. And it's the same as what happens in the churches, and it's the preparation, it's preparing for Christmas. But we do have a lot of children who are not Christian.
Yeah, so how do you manage with those children?
They join in general. If we're doing art that is particularly religious, they might, you know, if it's a background with a crib in the front, they'll do a background, but they can put something else in the front. They listen to the songs, but they don't necessarily join in. Some are allowed to join in, some are not allowed to join in. Some do a lot of extra library reading time while the others are singing, or the others are doing stuff that's particularly related to Christmas. Everybody's included. Now, we've been talking in my class about Christmas from around the world, and we ask parents to come in and chat to the kids about the country that they're from and what they do around Christmas or not, because of course some of them don't celebrate Christmas, so they might talk about New Year or Hanukkah or whatever else it is instead. So they come in and talk to the kids about that, and the children will tell me what their customs are, so that we all know that Christmas is different in different countries.
And what kind of planning do you have to do for all of this work?
Well, in the general planning, Christmas is incorporated a lot. So it's the main overriding theme in the thematic teaching for the month of December. But it's planning as usual, but the theme reflects the fact that it's coming up to Christmas.
You've also been busy with Science Week lately, because that's an area of major interest to you. Can you tell us a little bit about what you've been doing, either with your own class, but also what you've been doing in other schools as part of Science Week?
I'm from Galway. Science Week in Galway is 2 weeks. It's a science fortnight. We do things on the double. So for 1 week of that, I'll go out to other schools and do science in their schools, which they really enjoy. And usually it's either done as a demonstration for a group of kids, or else it's done as a workshop where the children actually do the experiments, and then we all walk around and have a look at our investigations or whatever the other children have done. So that's very interesting. Meanwhile, back in my own class, we're getting ready for Science Week. So what we do every year is we have a space and rocket morning, and the children will host the morning. They'll all sit on the edges, at the desks at the edges of the room, and they all have a stall with a planet or things about the International Space Station or a different topic on each stall, and other children from other classes will come and visit. And then after 10 minutes of visitation time, I ring a bell, and the visiting children will sit on the floor in the middle, and the visiting adults will go to the edges of the classroom, and my children then will demonstrate two different kinds of rockets. They launch two different kinds of rockets. So we have 11 rockets. So there are 22 children can each launch a rocket, explain how a rocket is launched, and then there's experiments on gravity and ones on a demonstration of a volcano that other children will come and see. And then at the end of the hour and a half, when we've had, we usually do it, we have about 12 classes that come to visit us. At the end of that time, we all go out to the yard and we take the big water rocket and air rocket, and we use bicycle pumps to pump these rockets, and the whole school and the senior school come and have a look at that. And we keep going until we lose them, until they go up on the roof.
And when you talk about all the different rockets, are these ones that are designed by the children, or do you give them the designs for them?
They do design their own rockets, and they would be on their stalls, and they design UFOs and things, and they would be on their own stalls. But the ones that we make mouse rockets, and you launch them by clapping your hands, both hands on a 2 litre milk, empty milk carton, and the little rocket mouse will launch up into space. And we have other ones that are made with straws. We have ones that are made with foam and elastics. We have ones.
And the ones made of straw, do you blow through the straw?
Blow through the straw, and the rocket head engages and takes off. That's only a very small one.
Right.
And then we have toilet roll rockets, and they're launched with chopsticks or with skewers.
And did you say one with elastics as well?
And then there's the biggest of the small ones is one made with insulation from radiators. And it's just got an elastic band on the top. And when you pull back on the elastic band, they fly a long way. When the kids get the hang of them, they fly a long way. And of course, they don't do any damage if they bump into things or people.
So because they're made of paper and cards?
They're made of foam.
All right.
Radiator foam.
Okay, so I'm trying to think of that foam. Is that...
It's insulation for the outside of a heating pipe, and it's okay. Just it's a silver pipe of foam.
Okay.
And you just cut off a piece and put on fins and elastic band on the top and lots of duct tape, and it really does fly.
So the children don't necessarily have a race to see who can get the highest with their rockets or the furthest or anything?
They can do. First of all, 1 year we had a knockout competition, because that explained how a knockout works, so that the end child was the child who had won each round in the knockout competition. Other years they can race each other and have a league, or they can do how far will it go, and then they can check the angle of launch and whether that has an influence on the distance that it travels. So we actually do have launchers with what looks like a protractor on them, and it's got a plumb line, and you can tell what angle of launch you have. And of course that feeds into, you know, when I'm kicking the ball, should I kick it straight, or should I kick it high, or should I kick it at an angle of about 40 degrees, or what should I do with the ball, or darts. Now children don't really play darts much, but footballs, all this angles and the angle of projection.
And the one you bring outside, the water one,
yes.
How does that work? That's obviously on a different scale.
Yeah, now that's a kit. You buy it. We buy it from ROKIT, rocket.com. And it is a kit, and you work it with an empty 2 litre bottle. And you buy the fins, the valve, and the pipe to connect it to your water pump, to your air pump, your bicycle pump. So you have to buy the bicycle pump, the 2 litre bottle, and of course you have to fill it about with a bit of water. The amount of water you put into it affects the speed and the direction of travel. So that's good for the older children. But for the younger ones, we just let it explode, and it's very good fun.
And you also did work on gravity. What did that involve?
Oh, the gravity is absolutely fantastic, because everybody knows that a heavier object will fall faster than a light object, except that that's wrong. And it's very interesting to see it in practice, where, you know, we start off with two pieces of paper, and I ask which one is heavier, and the children will say they're exactly the same. And then I roll one into a ball, and I say which one is heavier, and they will always say the ball, even though the piece of paper is exactly the same, so obviously the weight is still exactly the same. And we watch them fall, and obviously the one that's like a ball falls quicker, because there's no air resistance. But then I take out a stone and the balled up piece of paper, and I say, okay, now these are the same shape, but they're very different weights, which one will fall first? And they will say the stone, because it's heavier. And I will say, but last time you told me that the weight doesn't matter. So we watch it fall, and sure enough they fall at the same time. And then I get out two bottles, one with water and one with no water in it, and I say, okay, well now what do you think of the two bottles, which one will fall first? And one is heavier than the other, and of course their answer is always
the one full of water.
The one full of water. But if you try this, you will find out that they fall at exactly the same time, because if you take air resistance out of the equation, they will fall at the same time. And then we talk about Galileo, and we talk about the Leaning Tower of Pisa, and then we talk about the fact that when the men went to the moon, they dropped a hammer and a feather, but there was no air there, therefore there was no air resistance, and what happened to those. And then there's an experiment here that Brian Cox did in a vacuum chamber, and he dropped bowling ball at the same time as feathers, and which one landed first. And it's very interesting. Another interesting one is where we look at craters. So we drop marbles or different sized balls into a container of sand that has some chocolate powder on top. And we watch the crater that's formed when this meteorite falls. So the meteorite is just a ball, but we compare marbles and mini footballs and see do they make the same size crater or different size craters, and we try dropping the same marbles every time from different heights and see does that make a difference to the crater. And then we stick a whole lot of dinosaurs into our sand and we drop the asteroids again and we say, you know, what happened to the dinosaurs? So the children can see, now this is with small children, but they can very visually see that the dinosaurs will die if they're hit. But that didn't kill all the dinosaurs, but they can see the dust rising, and then they can talk about, well, if the dust gets in the way of the sun, what do you think happened to the earth? And if it happened to the earth, what happened to the food on the earth? What happened to the dinosaurs on the earth? And what happened to the dinosaurs? So that's history, and it's related to space as well, that they find very interesting. I find very interesting, and I'm doing it every year.
So you're also involved this year in the Féile Scoldromaíochta, Jane?
Well, every year. So the Féile Scoldromaíochta is where you would put on an Irish play or musical and compete with other schools in your area, in your age group, in your size school. So that there are very specific categories, but you put on a play. It can be one you wrote yourself or it can be one that you have bought. And all of these are put on in February. Our first round in Galway is always in February. It's the first week in February. And then if you win that round, you go through to the Connacht round and then you go through to the All-Irelands. I'm in a Jeish school and a lot of my children would struggle with English, never mind Irish, but they really enjoy it. And instead of worrying about Irish being another and difficult language, they do this play through Irish and they thoroughly enjoy it. So at the moment we've already learnt the songs and we're starting on the script, and then after Christmas we'll choose the parts. But by the time we choose the parts, everybody will be familiar with the songs and they'll be familiar with the script. Not that they'll know it, but they'll be familiar with it, and therefore learning their part becomes much easier. And we have a lot of backup so that if somebody is missing, everybody else knows their parts because we're all familiar with the script, which is quite nice.
And where did you get the script for this year?
This year's script is a translation of an existing script. Other years, some years, it's not. Last year we did the Willow Pattern, so that was one that I just composed.
And can you tell us what it is this year?
So this year it's a play called Tatty Bogle, and it's about a scarecrow who eventually loses his clothes and isn't a scarecrow anymore and grows up into a beautiful tree. It's lovely.
And I'll put a link to Jane Shimizu's busy classroom blog on the programme's website. Remember, you can download over 300 Inside Education podcasts at seandelaney.com/podcasts. My own book about teaching, Become the Primary Teacher Everyone Wants to Have, is available from online bookshops and on request from your local library. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.